Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends and neighbors, on this Friday morning, January 28th. Welcome to the Bill Press Pod and this week's Reporters Roundtable. With Congress out of session, what looked like a quiet week in the nation's capital turned out not to be, thanks especially to Justice Stephen Breyer. He knows the law and he knows politics. So Breyer decided to step down from the court at the end of this session when Democrats still have control of the Senate and President Biden has the best chance of winning confirmation for Breyer's replacement. And we all know about that new justice at this point. We know that it will be a she, and she will make history as the first African-American woman ever on the nation's highest court. Meanwhile, the January 6th Select Committee continued its probe into the insurrection, even though Newt Gingrich, yes, Newt Gingrich, threatened them all with jail time. And yet another president got caught saying stuff that he shouldn't have on a hot mic. Okay, let's jump right in with today's all-star panel. Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor, NBC News Digital. Hello, Ginger.
Hello, glad to be here.
David Jackson, National Political Correspondent for USA Today. Hi, David.
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Okay, and Jason Dick, Deputy Editor for CQ Roll Call. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Good morning, everybody.
All right. So, Jason, let's start with Justice Breyer. As Woody Allen told us, timing is everything, right? Even with the Supreme Court and for Joe Biden, Breyer's timing couldn't have been better, right?
That's right. Democrats have a tendency to get the timing of Supreme Court nominees and vacancies wrong. The Republicans are a lot more disciplined about retiring when there is a Republican president and a Republican Senate to confirm them over the last few, I don't know, decades. And this is why you see, you know, the shenanigans that happened with Merrick Garland in 2016 when Antonin Scalia died and Barack Obama nominated him and Mitch McConnell said, no, thanks. We'll wait. Yeah. We'll wait. So this, you know, this isn't going to alter the makeup of the court ideologically, but it is finally an instance where the Democrats seem to have aligned and said, like, okay, let's make sure that we can confirm somebody who is, you know, sort of in line with the president's policies and the president's sort of overall approach to politics and life, while we have the power to do so.
Right. And so, Ginger, for a moment, there was a brief speculation about whether President Biden would follow through with his promise to appoint the first African-American woman. Yesterday at the White House, when he accepted Justice Breyer's letter of resignation, the president made it clear, no doubt where he's going. Here he is.
Person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
So, Ginger, that is historic. What I find somewhat amusing about this is that the president is in effect saying, I will not consider any man at all. I will not consider any white woman, any Latina, any Asian American woman. I will only consider a Black woman for this job, which is the essence of affirmative action, which is before the court this year.
That's right. The court is probably going to whittle away at the affirmative action programs at some of our nation's private and public schools. But you're right. He said he made a promise and he was going to stick to it. It might be the only time that white men who thought that for a long time since their days in contract law in law school that they could be a Supreme Court justice one day don't really have that ability to think that it could be them this time, because it won't be. It will be a black woman. And Biden's point is that there are lots of qualified and have been lots of qualified black women for the court, and none of them have been nominated so far. And it's time that that was remedied. Obviously, we heard absolutely predictable criticism from the right that mm-hmm. meant he wasn't looking for the most qualified candidate. He was looking for a candidate that fit a certain profile. I think we're going to hear Democrats and the White House push back on that. And I think we're also going to see the president take a long time. You know, it's not going to be next week that he comes out and names a nominee, even if we all know that Ketanji Brown Jackson is at the top of his list. And the White House feels, we understand that that being more deliberative, taking some time, going over lots of candidates might sort of push back at some of that criticism that they didn't just pick someone mm-hmm. only because of their skin color and their being a woman.
But the president did say he'll make his choice by the end of February, which gives him like roughly 5 weeks, I guess, to do that deliberation you talk about. David, it's not all politics, but there is a lot of politics in this decision. I mean, is this an opportunity for Biden and for Democrats?
Well, they certainly see it that way. We've got, obviously, they're struggling in terms of the midterm elections. And I think there are some people, in fact, I know there are some people in the party who see this as an opportunity to energize progressive and Democratic voters, particularly voters of color. And I think they're going to go all out to promote this nominee, who I'm almost sure is going to be Judge Brown Jackson. I think that's a done deal. And I think that there's already a public relations effort to promote her candidacy, and they have a hopes that it will generate more black votes this November.
Mm-hmm. Jason, tell us a little bit about Breyer's legacy. He's been on the court for 27 years, and he was a man who came into the court saying, you know, I know how to get consensus. I know how to get people working together, right? I know how to just deal with the facts and get away from the politics. He gave an air of that yesterday, I thought, in his remarks at the White House, where he talked about democracy as an ongoing experiment. Here's the justice.
Of course, people don't agree, but we have a country that is based on human rights, democracy, and so forth. But I'll tell you what Lincoln thought, what Washington thought, and what people today still think. It's an experiment. I say, I want you to pick just this up. It's an experiment that's still going on.
Sounds a little almost old-fashioned, Jason.
Yeah, and I feel like you're right. I mean, Breyer sort of cultivated that old-fashioned, sort of vibe. I mean, he looks like a character from a different time almost. You know, he worked on the Senate for a while for Ted Kennedy in the Senate Judiciary Committee before becoming a judge. And, you know, he just has a very like sort of no nonsense, amiable approach to things. There was hard to find any Republicans who had anything bad to say about him. And they all, you know, sort of glommed onto that whole idea that, you know, that you could disagree with him without it being disagreeable. So, I mean, I think that, you know, some of the reason that we were just now kind of getting around to like, oh yeah, he was here for 27 years, you know, is that he was, you know, he was the other Clinton, pick for the Supreme Court. I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg cast such a large shadow, but Breyer seemed to revel in that. And I think that, you know, he was very conscientious of the image of the court in that way. I mean, he's kind of akin to John Roberts too. Roberts is very concerned that the public, you know, view the court as an impartial institution, that it's not driven by mm-hmm. politics, even though politics does drive it in so many ways. He's the best kind of fuddy-duddy, I guess, is the best way to say it.
I'm not sure he would appreciate that term, but at any rate. So, Ginger, bottom line, do they have the votes?
I would think it's going to be very easy for them to move the votes ahead. David said, you know, this is a nominee that we think is pretty much in the pipeline, is coming up. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, she passed the Senate in June on a 53-44 vote. So she got Republican support then. I think it will not be surprising if she gets Republican support again, unless something really goes off the rails. She's been vetted. She's well known. And you know, there was all this immediate speculation that Manchin and Sinema will again cause problems, but This is not their playground, right? Like, this is not a thing they want to cause problems on. They've supported the president's nominees. Manchin has been very open in supporting nominees of presidents of both parties, saying presidents are entitled to make their own appointments. I would be shocked if there's any type of rumbling. Don't get me wrong, we're going to hear rumbling. It's just not going to be consequential rumbling that ever likely puts much in jeopardy of not being approved.
Republicans seem to be a little flummoxed about how they handle this. Even Mitch McConnell hasn't come out full bore against anybody that Biden nominates. Here's the Republican leader, I think yesterday, the day before, when he said, well, I'm going to certainly consider whoever he puts up. Here's McConnell.
So, look, I'm going to give the president's nominee, whoever that may be, a fair look and not predict on today when we don't even know who the nominee is. I might vote.
And some Republicans, which is kind of amusing, David, are saying, now there's no rush here. We have to take our time. We have to go slow. Right. How do they handle this, do you think?
Well, they don't know. They're kind of in a wait and see mode, I think. I agree with Ginger. I think it's a done deal. And Biden will get his nominee probably by Memorial Day. The only question to me is how much the Republicans push back and whether they seek to make the court an election issue. And like I say, I don't think they really know right now. I know someone who's very involved in the judicial background issues, and he said that there's already a lot of investigating of Judge Brown Jackson, but the people he works for don't know whether they're going to use it or not. They're just going to wait and see what the public thinks. But the feeling is that they will raise a fuss, and they will try to get their own voters who are very interested in Supreme Court issues excited about the fact that there's a new liberal joining the court. And I think you'll hear a little bit of shouting, but I don't think you'll hear much, because obviously the Republicans are very sensitive about the racial thing. And so they don't want to be seen as attacking the first black female nominee.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the January 6th Select Committee, even though Congress was not in session this week, there was a lot of news on that front, particularly as they go through the documents that they received from the archives after the Supreme Court refused to agree with Donald Trump's claim of executive privilege. This week, I thought we saw three big developments on that front. There was a revelation that several states had put together fake electoral slates that they were going to send to Congress at the instigation of Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and others. A memo circulating that suggested the president should declare martial law to require a new election be held, and a draft executive order showing that the president did not sign, but which would have required the military to seize voting machines around the country. Jamie Raskin quoted this week as saying, boy, when you add this up, this amounts to a real coup d'etat or attempted. Here is Congressman Raskin, member of the January 6th committee.
We have filled in a lot more evidence that he wasn't just inciting an insurrection. He was working to organize a coup against the democracy in order to seize the presidency for another 4 years. And so I can't imagine that the Department of Justice would not have evidence at this point.
Jason, this really raises the stakes of what they're looking at.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is, I think, an indication of how what we have missed in not having a bipartisan commission, a bipartisan independent commission, which,
good point.
You know, this passed the House with bipartisan support from several Republicans, and then it died in the United States Senate, despite, of course, getting 54 votes. and, you know, because it couldn't overcome a 60-vote hurdle, you know, we because it's only the House Select Committee, you know, Republicans have tried to really cast aspersions on this as a partisan exercise. But this is, you know, this is real oversight. And this is, you know, they're going through documents. They're doing the hard work of this. And, you know, they are looking, you know, nervously at the clock, too, because, you know, if Republicans do retake the House, it is hard to imagine that Kevin McCarthy, as the speaker, would continue to, you know, support a select committee that is investigating Donald Trump and the efforts of his allies. And, you know, this is the evidence is all right there. I mean, I remember, you know, a couple of weeks ago on the podcast that I host, Political Theater, I was talking to Timothy Snyder, the author of On Tyranny. And he likened, you know, what happened on January 6th to it, the beer hall putsch, you know, in Germany, which was this sort of, you know, relatively disorganized effort to, you know, overtake the German government, and they came back much more organized. Now Trump, you know, won't have the Justice Department at his beck and call in 2024, but the effort to continue to undermine the election continues, at least in politics and the way people are trying to cast it. And we're just seeing how involved it was. It really was a lot more organized than we have than was thought.
If there's an effort to undermine the government, Ginger, there's also an effort to undermine the January 6th committee. I thought an indication of how Republicans might be getting a little nervous about how far the committee is going came last Sunday on Fox News when they rolled Newt Gingrich out to issue this warning. Here he is.
We're going to have a Republican majority in the House and a Republican majority in the Senate. And all these people who've been so tough and so mean and so nasty are going to be delivered subpoenas for every document, every conversation, every tweet, every email, because I think it's clear that these are people who are literally just running over the law, pursuing innocent people, causing them to spend thousands and thousands of dollars in legal fees for no justification. And it's basically a lynch mob. And unfortunately, the Attorney General of the United States has joined that lynch mob and is totally misusing the FBI. And I think when you have a Republican Congress, this is all going to come crashing down. And the wolves are going to find out that they're now sheep. And they're the ones who are, in fact, going to, I think, face a real risk of jail for the kind of laws they're breaking.
So there you go, Ginger. Jail time for doing their jobs, right?
Yeah, you know, I covered Newt Gingrich's 2012 campaign, and he is one who is wont to make sort of empty threats. I think he thinks it gets the base riled up. And look, like, Republicans have been doing this now. We all can remember "Lock her up," the chant. Trump took office, and did they lock her up? No, because it's absurd, and she didn't commit any crimes. And people doing their jobs and investigating and conducting oversight are not committing any crimes. So this all feels very empty to me. But it is. Talking to a segment of the population, right? And just telling them, you're entitled to be mad about this. You're entitled to think that they're doing wrong because they're committing a crime. And they listen to Newt Gingrich and they listen to other Trump allies and they say, you know what, these people are criminals and we don't have to listen to them. It's really just this ongoing effort to erode American confidence in our government, in our elections, in the way that we do things. And you know, as was just said, there's not the levers, you know, Trump pulled every lever of power that he had at his disposal to try to overturn his defeat. It didn't work. If he runs again, surely he will try to pull as much as he can. He will not have the same levers of power. So they have to find that support in other ways. And I think that, you know, it is a reminder that what we're watching when we watch the January 6th committee, when we watch discussions about this, that this is not something that happened and is over, right? This is something that is ongoing, and it is continuously part of the American system, government, politics, equation, experiment, mm-hmm. whatever term we want to use. right. It is a live action play happening in front of us as we try to uncover what happened in the first act, and we're not sure if we're in the second or the third.
But David, doesn't this get us back to, again, the midterms? And each party trying to position itself for the midterms, that this is Newt Gingrich has been tasked by Donald Trump and Kevin McCarthy in crafting the message Republicans ought to use in the midterms. This is this is one of the things they're going to use, right?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And I don't know about jail time. I mean, obviously, I guess you can't be a politician today unless you threaten to throw your opponent in jail. But, there will be. I mean, you're already starting to hear this let's impeach Joe Biden talk. I mean, if the Republicans do indeed take the House, there is going to be quite an uptick in investigative activity of the Biden administration. You're going to hear right wingers call for Biden's impeachment. I mean, that's just the world we live in right now. I confess I'm a bit of an agnostic on the January 6th, all this stuff that's coming out. I mean, this is all stuff we knew about at the time. We just didn't take it very seriously back in December and January. To me, the one difference is that the committee is unearthed documents and showing how these things were discussed in the White House with Trump. But we still don't know how seriously Trump himself took it and whether he would in fact seriously considered seizing the voting machines. At the time, the people in the White House said that it wasn't. He was just venting and giving off steam, and all these wild-eyed fanatics were coming into the White House and encouraging him to do this, that, or the other thing. But no one really took it seriously. Obviously, the January 6th committee took it seriously, and I guess we'll find out how seriously voters take it.
Again, in terms of the midterms and in terms of messaging for the midterms, the New York Times lead article this morning, last year, the economy grew 5.7%, the largest annual increase since 1984. Given that, Jason, are the midterms as bleak for Democrats as everybody's predicting?
When I saw that number, I was a little shocked myself, just how much growth the country experienced. I think that certainly gives Democrats an argument. The issue is does it prevail over inflation and sort of the erosion of some of the spending power of that economic growth, and then also just in general, what Democrats are facing is something that is very tough to overcome, even in sort of the best circumstances. You know, people get grumpy in a president's first midterm, regardless of the economy sometimes, and seek to punish that party. And they're swimming against that. And then also because this is right after a redistricting round, you know, we don't know the exact outcome. I mean, it seems like Democrats did a little better than people were predicting with redistricting because of either court challenges or because, you know, some of the bigger states like Texas didn't look to eliminate, you know, as many Democratic seats as they could. But, you know, you see a high number of open seats with a much higher number of open seats among Democrats. You got people like Jim Cooper, who's been in Congress for 30 some odd years, retiring because they carved up his district in Nashville. You know, that adds to the uncertainty of being a Democrat. I think the real wild card is more in the Senate because Senate, you know, statewide dynamics are a lot different than at the House level. I'd probably, you know, say that the Republicans they would rather be Republicans than Democrats going into the midterms, but the Senate is still a little bit uncertain. I mean, in 2018, you know, the Republicans lost 41 seats in the House and Democrats retook the majority, but the Republicans gained 2 seats in that election cycle, even with this widespread discontent with Trump. So I don't think it's bleak and grim and a bloodbath in the way it's been described, but it's, you know, when you only have a 5 seat margin in the House, that's pretty easy to lose just because of, you know, just overall uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ginger, I'm sure when Joe Biden picked up the paper this morning or when he heard this yesterday, I'm sure he heard it before he saw it in the paper, right? His response must be, why aren't I getting more credit for this?
I think that we saw that during his press conference last week. And this has been a really unfortunate and I can't imagine successful Democratic message that we've heard in the last year. And we heard a lot in the Obama administration, which was, I know you think it hurts and your pocketbook hurts and your financial situation is difficult, but really look at these statistics. It's not that bad. It's really not that bad. No one is convinced by that, right? Mm-hmm. No one stops and says, I know I'm paying more for a gallon of milk and I have less disposable income and I'm going to buy my kid one less toy for their birthday this year. But the president said that the GDP growth was fantastic. So everything must really be great, right? It just doesn't work that way. And if it did, the American politics would look very different right now. And so, yeah, it's great. It's great for America. It's great for the economy. It should be great for Biden, but they have to figure out how to make it great for people who are voting for them. Otherwise, it won't matter what number is splashed across the front of the New York Times homepage. It will be lost on someone who's still trying to make ends meet.
Messaging, messaging, messaging. Well, we've covered a lot of the big news, but maybe not the biggest story of the week, which we'll get to right after the break, which is what President Biden did while Ukraine was on the brink of war. It's the Bill Press Pod, today's roundtable with Ginger Gibson from NBC News Digital, David Jackson, USA Today, and Jason Dick from CQ Roll Call. Take a quick break and we'll come back and pick things up from there and get to everything that we missed. And today's roundtable here on the Bill Press Pod brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A, over 500,000 strong. Under the leadership of President Terry O'Sullivan, the Laborers Union, the backbone of the American labor movement, very, very active in the construction field. They're building infrastructure even before the new infrastructure bill is kicked in. In the energy field, building old-fashioned pipelines as well as wind turbines and solar panels. And in the healthcare field, public employees active in healthcare. We salute the members of the Laborers Union. Thank them for their good work, their support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at LIUNA, LIUNA.org.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back on this Friday, January 28th, at the Bill Press Pod and today's roundtable, Reporters Roundtable. Jason Dick, Deputy Editor of CQ Roll Call, David Jackson, National Political Correspondent for USA Today, and Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor of NBC News Digital. Yes, on the brink of war with Ukraine, the stock market tottering, Congress still deadlocked, even though they're out of town. And what did Joe Biden do? He went out for ice cream. Man, Fox News, this was the biggest scandal to hit the White House, I think, since Watergate, at least. Here, thanks to The Daily Show, a little chorus of outrage from the hosts on Fox News.
President Biden took a trip off campus today to an ice cream parlor.
He just exited Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams in Washington at 2:25, emerged with two scoops of what appeared to be chocolate.
The president yesterday went out for ice cream. Ice cream. Ice cream. Ice cream. Ice cream. Two scoops and a waffle cone.
All I have to do is run a country of 350 million.
Having the time to stop by, get some ice cream. This as, of course, chaos is erupting across our own nation and now abroad.
Is it appropriate at this time, Vladimir Putin, watching this commander-in-chief chomping on ice cream?
Why is Putin doing this? Because he knows Biden's weak. Biden would rather have ice cream with somebody rather than stand up for Americans.
Joe Biden's weakness, his feebleness, his love of ice cream.
We've got inflation through the roof, and the White House gets ice cream.
Even in the most dire crises, there's always a little time for ice cream.
The world is falling apart thanks to his weakness, and Joe Biden gets ice cream. Look at that, a double scoop there, old Joe.
Joe is not fit to serve. U.S. presidents don't just hang out at ice cream parlors and then call it a day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That is not normal.
It's also
enough, Sean Hannity, the most outrageous of all. So Ginger, oh my God, what's going on?
Well, they we had to go from the tree set on fire. That was losing steam, so we needed something else to be upset about. So now we've got ice cream and Biden hot mic, maybe. Not so hot.
We'll get to that.
All the outrage. I mean, look, like, I think that reducing the U.S. foreign policy and the foreign policy of a man who served on the Foreign Policy Foreign Affairs Committee in the Senate for decades down to ice cream really misses what's going on here. This is a tremendous test right now on this White House that, you know, botched Afghanistan and took a ton of criticism for how that was handled. Now the next big foreign policy test is here. Of course, Fox is going to see it differently. They are hawks. They are driven by a hawk message, and they are not going to like anyone who doesn't immediately want to line up tanks on the Ukrainian border and point them at Russia and say, you know, give me your best shot. This is
unless you're Tucker Carlson, of course.
Unless you're Tucker Carlson, right? Or Donald Trump, by the way, who they like to imagine would be doing what they want to do right now. But let's be clear, he was not really interested in helping anyone that wasn't America for his 4 years in office. So it's much more. Ice cream is absurd. It is cold here in Washington, so there's that. But I a pregnant woman haven't stopped eating ice cream through the winter, so. Sympathies to Biden on that. I think that the foreign policy comparisons to ice cream are not quite as cut and dry as Fox might like
them.
Well,
not to make too much of that, but by the way, I wish Vladimir Putin would go out for ice cream. It might smooth things, ease the tension a little bit. Jason, nobody's talking about the fact that you and I live on Capitol Hill, right? This is a small business on Capitol Hill. I'm old enough to remember the days when Republicans supported small businesses. It was good, right, to support a small business.
Yeah, and you know, like, taking a step back, I mean, this is a short drive, you know, from the White House down Pennsylvania Avenue to Barracks Row and then right to Ginny's Splendid Ice Cream, which is, you know, delicious. It's a little expensive, but it is really good ice cream. And then also, you know, he's hung out with a few other shopkeepers in the area, said hi to the Marines standing guard outside the Commandant's, you know, residence in Barracks Row. You know, this is what a president does. You know, I guess, you know, he stepping away from the script of, like, you know, eating boiled asparagus or something, you know, and looking dour and over charts, you know, or, you know, like giant, you know, maps of Ukraine should be the image. But, you know, the truth is that no matter what he does, you know, Hannity and all these folks are going to go after him. You know, but, all I can say is I wish he would have gone with a tan suit also. And then they all would have lost their minds and not known which where to attack him first.
Well, David Jackson, you covered the White House for many years before you moved up to this exalted position of national political correspondent. Joe Biden, reporters come in and they always ask questions and they always shout out questions as they're being herded out of the room. It happened again this week, of course, when Peter Ducey from Fox tried to get in a question about inflation in the midterms. And Joe Biden not realizing his mic was still on. Kind of hard to hear Ducey's question, but here's you can certainly hear the president whispering his reaction. Here's that little exchange.
Do you think inflation is a political liability?
That's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a bitch.
Goes back to Reagan's hot mic moment and, and other
hard bombing in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Big deal, David?
No, not really. But, you know, I've periodically done stories about presidents who saying things they wish they hadn't have said, so I had to update that one this week.
I'll bet.
It was about presidents and the press. The one it reminded me of was when George Bush, then a candidate, described Adam Clymer as a major league you-know-what.
Right.
That's, you know, it's just one of those things that happens. I mean, in this case, I know I've been told that Biden kind of likes to call on the conservative reporters and the Fox reporters to, quote, expose them for what they are, end quote. So he definitely had a, you know, he definitely had some, he's had to, you know, he did that at the press conference last week. He called on a couple reporters from conservative outlets. So also the question, I mean, Peter Ducey is not very popular in the White House because people feel like he only asks, when are you going to stop beating your wife questions? And the question here was, hey, inflation is really going to hurt you, isn't it, Mr. President? Mm-hmm. I kind of liked Biden's initial answer. No, it's an asset. And I thought that was pretty funny. But
yeah,
he probably shouldn't have gone on and made it so personal. He probably should have just said it was a blanking stupid question or something like that. But I don't think it's a particularly big deal.
You know, what I thought was most interesting is the president, of course, called Ducey that night to say, hey, you know, nothing personal. But then Ducey said, well, Mr. President, I always try to ask a question that nobody else is going to ask. Right. I mean, and Biden said, you've got to, which I thought really showed a lot about Biden's understanding of what the reporter's job is.
Biden gets it. Biden gets it for sure. Now, he understands what Ducey's doing. And I think Ducey understands what Biden is doing. So it's all good. These things happen.
Yeah. Well, so sprinkled throughout our conversation has been the question of Ukraine, which is really a guessing game right now. I've never seen a time when the White House, the State Department, everybody admits they don't know what the hell Putin is going to end up doing. What's your best guess, Jason? What are we headed for?
I mean, it seems like, you know, Putin has already accomplished his goal in a lot of ways, which is, you know, the instability of the West to keep people going. I mean, this guy did run the KGB, right? You know, so he is an expert at keeping people off balance. I don't think that, like, as long as he is in office, that Ukraine will ever sleep easy, you know, without one eye open. I would guess that, you know, maybe there's some sort of event, who knows, but I mean, a full scale war with a lot of, you know, casualties and so forth, that I just have a tough time thinking that Putin thinks that is a good idea at this point, where, you know, he can, if he were to back off right now and say, like, well, you know, we got what we accomplished. We sort of, you know, called attention to the imperialism of the West and all this kind of stuff, and we're going to keep fighting. You know, I mean, he's got an iron grip, you know, on the press in Russia, so he can spin it however he wants. And he really doesn't care what we think, as long as we're, you know, sort of guessing and scratching our heads. And I think that this is just more of the same. So, I mean, I really hope that it doesn't get into any, like, sort of tragic moorings. I mean, you know, when major news outlets all start moving and broadcasting and so forth from Kyiv, I mean, it sort of sends a chill down, and we're talking about, you know, like, all kinds of problems. But I just feel like, you know, Putin has kind of gotten he's already accomplished some of his goals, which is to scare everybody and keep everybody on their toes. And so if he can get away without having to inflict mass casualties on his own or in Ukraine, he's already kind of won.
Well, people certainly are concerned, Ginger. And as Jason points out, you know, it leads almost every newscast and front page of the papers. But are the American people ready for war in Ukraine?
I think that's going to be a very difficult sell for the American people. The American people, who we've already said at length, are dealing with economic struggles, who are still coming out of this pandemic, who are not going to be particularly interested in footing the bill for someone, what they will view as someone else's war, an excursion in to Ukraine, try to explain Article 5 to the American people that we need to send troops to Romania is not exactly going to be an easy sell. And so I think you're right. I think it is a difficult argument. And I think that Putin clearly understands that. And to Jason's point, is getting some things, right? He's getting people scared. He's trying to extract concessions about NATO, about the Ukraine status in NATO. He really doesn't want anybody on his border that would be entitled to Article 5 protections. And so he's doing nearly whatever it would take to stop that. So I do think that it's going to be hard to convince the American people. And frankly, in part, because we didn't really do a good job of explaining to the American people, particularly Article 5, the only time it's ever been invoked prior, which was to come to the aid of the United States. So I think that also makes it hard to make this sell.
Right. So, David, I'm curious about what the Republican position on this is, because, and Jason alluded to this earlier, I believe, on the one hand, you've got Jim Inhofe and Mitch McConnell and others saying, Biden's not doing enough, right? He's got to be tougher. And then you've got Tucker Carlson and other Trumpers saying, no, we ought to be supporting Russia, not Ukraine. So what's the Republican position on this?
They really don't have one. I think they're anti-Russian, but you're right. I mean, the Tucker Carlson, Donald Trump entente, they've really put pressure on Republicans to take Russia's side in this, as amazing as it sounds. I just think it's yet another, it's yet emblematic of the basic problem the Republicans have with Trump, because it's really splitting the party and on this issue in particular. But I think basically the Republican Party opposes a Russian invasion of Ukraine, but they're really not going to do anything about it if it happens. And it's more about them contending with the Trump wing of their party.
Well, the idea of supporting Russia in an invasion of Ukraine is certainly not one that the American people are going to support. I mean,
no, it's incredible. I mean, just look at the relationship that Russia and Trump had, and vice versa. It's really a topsy turvy world, both in American politics and in international relations.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to watch them sort of try to.
By the way, one thing about Putin is I can't help but think about the fact that he invaded Georgia near the start of the 2008 Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
Well, the Winter Olympics in China begin a week from today, next Friday. So
he'll be there for the opening, right?
Right.
It's
going to be interesting.
And let's also not forget that he did invade Ukraine once and seized Crimea when President Obama was in the White House and got away with it. So put that in context as well. All right. So lots going on, lots to talk about. We don't want to let you go, though, without of all the stories this week that we did or did not talk about, which one was the one that caught your attention the most, your favorite story of the week? Ginger, start us off.
Yeah, so I'm going to point you to a story that actually got done by one of my reporters this week. I thought it was really great and really an important thing to do. Alex Seitzwald wrote a story this week about the non-Trump Republicans that are disappearing. They're really the end of them. Larry Hogan, Charlie Baker, Arizona Governor Ducey. He talked to Larry Hogan about what this means for the future of their party. And they really are the last ones. I mean, there's probably a handful in Congress left. Maybe two, it is a moment that should not be lost on us, that the state houses and the governors were really sort of the counterforce to Trump that remained, and that we're able to be independent of them, and they are slipping away.
Very interesting, because there are, of course, those voices like Charlie Sykes and Bill Kristol, right, and Christine Todd Whitman, and others who are still trying to get back to the old Republican Party, but you're saying is the office holders, right, who dared stand up to Trump are disappearing. Alex Seitzwald, he's one of our best guests on the roundtable, and he's one of your best reporters as well. That's great. David Jackson, what caught your attention?
Well, I was going to talk about the NFL playoffs, but we've got breaking news here that I think would be interesting. The White House cat
has
arrived. Willow, a gray cat from Pennsylvania who caught the first lady's eye during some appearance she made. Cat snuck up on stage with the first lady, and she took quite a shine to her. Well, he is now the latest, he or she is now the latest White House resident. And So yeah, the White House finally has a cat. It's something people have been asking about for months.
We wonder how the first cat will get along with the first dog.
Oh, I don't know. You know, those Biden dogs have been known to be kind of tested. It could be a rivalry.
I have to point out that I have a granddaughter, wonderful granddaughter, by the name of Willow.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And of course, Willow's from California. So I see what they. All right. The first cat. And Jason.
I am looking forward to the first White House cat videos.
Oh, they'll get here.
Oh, you know.
Rest assured.
Coming. Oh, yeah.
Mine is a little weird, but it's not about movies, Bill.
So oh, no.
It is still in the art sphere. One of my kind of go-to authors, you know, writers that I always head towards every week is Michael Derda in the Washington Post.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
always has a weird, you know, take on books, or he's reading some 16th century manuscript or something like that. And he had this, it was actually kind of personal, kind of journey-like this past week. He went up to New York. He was a little concerned about it just because it was during Omicron, but he went up to New York last week. He's boosted and vaxxed and so forth for the annual meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars in New York City. This is a group of Sherlock Holmes fans. They collect manuscripts, ephemera. It's a wonderful geeky world of mystery aficionados and all things Sherlockian. And the way that he was able to communicate just how odd this is, and at the same time sort of inviting people in, was just a real pleasure to read.
Michael Derda, he's a great writer and a great book collector. He hangs out at Capitol Hill Books, which is a favorite haunt of Jason's and mine here on Capitol Hill. So my favorite story of the week is along those lines. I'm sure you heard about, and maybe some of you took part in, the auction that occurred for the personal library of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like many of us in Washington, she had a library full of a lot of books that had been signed to her, inscribed to her. Bonhams got a hold of her library. They put it up for auction. It included her college yearbooks, these books that had been signed to her, her favorite novels. And they had a total price of $60,000 for the whole lot, which is about 3,000 books. The interest in Ruth Bader owning a book that Ruth Bader Ginsburg once owned was so phenomenal that they actually pulled in $2.4 million, 3,900% over what they expected. and they, for example, her copy of Beloved, signed by Toni Morrison, sold. It was put up there for a bid of $500, sold for $31,600. Gloria Steinem's memoir, which had been listed at $600, sold for $52,800. So, hey, folks, all of us have a lot of books on our shelves. This is a sign of hope. Here's what to do, right? Put your book up for auction. If only we had the celebrity of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it might work. But there are a lot of people out there still interested in book collecting, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it shows, is still a very popular person and celebrity, and will be probably forever. Hey, what a great roundtable. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. David Jackson from USA Today, Ginger Gibbs, NBC News Digital, and Jason Dick, of course, from CQ Roll Call. We thank you, panelists, and we thank you all, listeners, for being here with us again. Have a great weekend. Please continue to take all the precautions necessary to deal with Omicron. And then come back next week for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod, talking to Elizabeth Wydra, head of the Constitutional Accountability Center. We're going to do a deep dive with Elizabeth into the term of Justice Stephen Breyer on the bench, his legacy, about his possible successor, and the direction that the court is taking these days. Elizabeth Wydra with us next Tuesday. Again, have a great weekend. We'll see you on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.